Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
And we now turn from leadership. Well, we don't turn away from leadership. We continue on the leadership theme all the way till 7:30. Our next guest allows us to turn our attention to healthcare and finance. Adrian Gore is the Group CEO of Discovery and joins me now to discuss their results, which were pretty healthy that came through. Key themes that he highlighted in delivering results this afternoon: strong earnings growth, value, cash generation, and capital resilience. Adrian Gore, welcome to Kaya Biz. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So we've seen at a group level, I suppose the key headline that everybody's speaking about is an increase in the dividend by 3 times. Talk to us a little bit about the what drove that.
Well, I think the group, you know, has entered a new phase of growth. So we kind of invested heavily in big initiatives like Discovery Bank that really has come through very, very strongly. So we've had kind of a combination on this year of just a very different kind of performance that puts us in a very different phase of growth. So our big businesses are growing nicely, but the new starts like Discovery Bank are coming through. The effect of that is much stronger growth, cash generation, etc. And the dividend is following that. We are still using a 5 times dividend coverage, so the dividend is, you know, I think conservative, but the rate of growth of it is very strong. And we made it clear that, you know, for the next 5 years, we expect strong 15 to 20% growth per annum. So the group's in a very strong position.
It certainly is. And to correct myself, I said over 3 times instead of over a third. Apologies. 38% was the increase in the dividend. All right. So let's drill down a little bit into that. You mentioned Discovery Bank, and we've been speaking about that here on Kaya Biz. You know, as a newcomer, and particularly without the traditional bricks and mortar standpoint, and the leaning among South African consumers towards digital and online banking, 1 million customers brought on board has been a really great milestone, hasn't it?
It's been remarkable. I mean, the hypothesis of building a digital bank, but one that was full service, you know, not a skinny kind, but a proper, based on our Vitality shared value model, has proven to be incredibly successful. But the 1 million customers coming on are using the bank at a substantial rate. So the, you know, kind of the revenue flow, the scale of engagement have all exceeded expectation. And it's just performing a lot better. Beside the numbers and the growth, the actual qualitative measures, you know, service measures, the kind of feedback from customers, et cetera, it's been remarkable.
That's absolutely fantastic. Can we turn for a moment to the medical scheme, specifically Discovery Health, and its ability to grow? You lamented a slew of complexities in the macroeconomic arena that have obviously faced all businesses. And I'm curious, you know, with the closure of various schemes, there's a natural, I think, attraction or ability for Discovery to mop up demand. What's your sense of growth prospects for the Med scheme?
The Discovery Health medical scheme is nearly 58% of the market. So its ability to grow is not easy. It's a fairly stagnant market, just given rates of medical inflation. So the business grows, and Discovery Health medical scheme is incredibly strong. And I think that provides members with a real sense of security in very difficult times. But just bear in mind, you know, at 2.7 million members, we kind of lose, you know, 200,000 a year, just natural lapsation, you know what I mean, just turnover. So you've got to grow by 200,000 to stand still. Gives you a sense of the numbers. But so growth is of course imperative. I think we will grow. We've launched some very important new products. But, you know, it has a massive social responsibility, and I think its strength is important in that regard.
Can we talk a bit about that social responsibility as it pertains to policy discussions in the country? 2.7 million members, albeit 57% of the private market, is a thin base upon which it seems, and you'll correct me where I'm wrong, it seems as though the NHI sort of eyes that pot as available for the social support. We've heard the various voices in the press, whether it be from Busa or the president, around discussions on the NHI. I understand Busa did have a meeting regarding this. Has there been any progress? And I'm sure it's not necessarily the time for you to tell us the details thereof. But have there been any progress in discussions either with DOH, Treasury, Busa, or business leaders in general?
You know, the business has been absolutely firm on its view that NHI is not workable without private sector participation. And just factually, it needs more funding, it needs more doctors, it needs more, not less. And the money paid by members to medical schemes is their money. You know,
exactly.
You have to raise taxes for Medicare, et cetera. So these are complicated issues. To be fair, those points are accepted. I don't think there's any real view that NHI is going to be implemented in a draconian way tomorrow. That's not the case. So, you know, we're trying to give members comfort that that's not going to happen. But at the same time, we have to engage very carefully and be unequivocal in our kind of need to make sure that we find solutions. You know, forget about our members. At the end of the day, the employed sector, which is the skills-based, that the country relies on, has to be secure in its healthcare in some way. And we have to meet the needs of all South Africans. It's complicated. The meeting this week is the first time that business formally engaged on this post the signing of the Act. And I think there is productive. It is constructive and potentially productive. The business government partnership that focused on load shedding and on transport and whatever, which is going very, very well, has built high level trust and good faith with the presidency and government. And the meeting came out in a very constructive way about let's find solutions here. You know, we're not bickering about platitudes. We have an act in place. How do we find ways to make that act work? This is a long, decade-long, intergenerational complexity, but I think we will find solutions, and we need to engage. There are parties litigating, potentially, so there's all kinds of very strong views. Mm-hmm. That's possibly not helpful. You know, we need strong views in this from all over, but the meeting between business and the presidency and government kind of left by saying, let's find solutions, and I think we can and must, and work is already taking place in that regard.
I'm happy to hear that, Adrian, because, you know, as much as I heard the president's call for solutions, and you'll help me here, as I look at the Act, and I have not read it in the same detail that actuaries would have and with the same aggressive eye, but just as I look at it, it feels as though there isn't almost enough on the table to provide solutions about. Everything that we hear from business is very constructive, as you say. Business leaders almost unanimously support the idea of universal healthcare, but the implementation is not necessarily, as you say, whether from funding or actual logistics and operations, we might need to find one another. I'm thinking about Clause 33 and sort of the range of medical services that can be funded by medical schemes. Those don't seem to be articulated clearly. I've seen a report from Discovery that highlights the degree of VAT or the degree of personal income tax that would have to increase in order to fund this sort of 200 billion was the X number that was put as a suggestion to assess this. Perhaps it's better for me to say to you, Adrian, as an operator in this industry, knowing the machinations and the complexities thereof, if universal healthcare is something that's in your mind, how would you put together the solution in your best case scenario?
Well, I think you know, one of the, you know, we modeled that 200 billion and first you found where do you get it from? You know, you'd have to raise taxes by 30% and the resulting healthcare to medical scheme members employed would go down 70% because you spread it. And in fact, people using the public sector would be up to 700 rand a month, which is not enough. So it doesn't get you there. You know, that's the problem. The solution is not simple, and I'd be way too arrogant to tell you what that solution is. But I do think that solution will involve a multi-fund approach. I think the pinch point of that Section 33 is the idea of one fund can satisfy everything. You know, that's at the core of flexibility that is not workable. There are a number of other clauses in that are just that are not workable, that obviously doctors are concerned about, etc. But the pinch point, I think, is that Section 33. It's not a medical scheme issue, and I hope I'm not talking my book, but it's the idea that if you're on one fund to fund everything, you've got a restriction that just can't spread, you know.
Yeah.
So I think solutions will be about freeing that up and creating a multi-funder system. But the NHI has a role to play, a massive role. And I think the ability to build on the NHI, make it workable, but introduce additional funding, I think is where that solution will lie. And we'll find that solution. I think, you know, listening to some of the emotions all around, I think there's a realization that we have to do that. The one point to just make is that you'd need economic growth of like 8 or 9% a year for a decade or more to free up 200 billion. You know what I mean? For healthcare, just in general. So, you know,
I'm sorry,
I mean,
I'm just checking the sky for a pig.
No, but there's no, I have to say, there's no in that. That's a tragedy. It's a tragedy of our country. We have a narrow tax base. So there's no, I don't think anyone here is trying to say it can't be done. We have to find ways to do it. But you can't have a current status quo where you know, 80% of South Africans have access to subpar healthcare. We have to deal with that as well.
Agreed.
So this is not about one sector. We do have to find a solution for South Africans. But there's smart people around, you know, and with good faith, you can make it work, I can tell you.
For those who happen to be within the private sector or reliant on the private sector, increases are in premier are continue to be, you know, well above inflation persistently. Is there a structural shift, I mean, that could assist those increases to come down? Whether it's, I don't know if it's, yeah, let me leave it at that.
There is. I mean, the current, you know, if you look at the rates of medical inflation, you know, 7 to 10%, our options are going up by. I mean, that's really problematic for people. We know that. You know, it's incredibly difficult. But what's driving that, you've got kind of core tariffs going up at inflation rates, 4.8 to 5% in our case. So we're keeping those under control. The issue is utilization, you know, aging, chronicity, et cetera. And the reason for that is you've got a system of community rating where you've got a flat rate. You know, there's no difference in what people pay, which is socially a good thing. And people can move in and out fairly freely, although their waiting periods generally, healthy people can stay out or buy very cheap options. When they're sick, they move up. The cost of that adverse selection, the cost of that churn adds about 2% a year. So when you compound that over 10 years, the compound effect is like 20, 25%. So 25% of what people are spending is the cost of that selection. You with me?
I am.
So it's not the cost of the underlying goods and services. It's the dynamics. If there is a structural change, getting more young people into the system, bringing down prescribed minimum benefits to levels that are more affordable and don't create a set of benefits you have to pay no matter what. There are things that can be done, and there have been a lot of inquiries into it. From our perspective, we must manage it. That's our job. We have to make sure we can keep it affordable. You know, we're introducing new options now that are lower priced. We're focusing heavily on chronicity, on trying to make people healthier. The results are very strong. So we've got a lot of work to do. That's our job. We have a responsibility to our members and to society. But there are issues that I think often people don't understand, that it's not just the cost of goods and services that's driving the cost up. But I must say, though, just on the positive, the quality of what people do in private healthcare, the quality of technology, you know, we're at the cutting edge in many ways.
Yeah.
And that does have a new effect. So it's a balancing act, you know, and again, I think, you know, being histrionic is problematic. We need to really try and find solutions, and we have a role to play in making sure it's affordable, you know, and we have to do that. That's our job.
Amongst those structural changes, two questions and I'll let you go. I'm quite sure you've got a busy evening ahead. Amongst those structural changes, media reports, and I'd be curious to know how you and other actuaries are seeing this, keep on highlighting the benefits of technological advancements, as you say, that we are on the cutting edge of obesity drugs and other kinds of sort of developments and R&D that one would imagine is apparently supposed to be giving us better longevity, better health during that longevity. And, you know, the old adage, the person who will live to 200 years old has already been born. To what extent does that kind of come into your projections, your actuarial projections, and should that not help us structurally start to see premier come down?
It's a great question. The reality is that healthcare is increasing life expectancy. We see now in areas of prostate cancer, breast cancer, you know, the technology works, but those benefits are seen in productivity and life expectancy. It costs more in healthcare. And you know, there's a lot of studies on this. In most industries, technology brings prices down. In healthcare, technology drives prices up.
Ah.
You know, so the benefits are felt elsewhere in the economy, but people have to pay more for it. So I think you're right, but you won't see that in the savings in the healthcare bill until technology brings efficiency to healthcare, which it hasn't done. It's brought just layers of more technology, which is great for society, but there's a cost to it. And I know, certainly in our membership base, our sense is that people want access to the best. They don't want to compromise on that. So that's kind of the tension you've got to manage. You know, an egalitarian system that allows some adverse selection, a system that funds the best technology, and people that are battling to afford it. You know, that's kind of the kind of trilemma in a way, you know.
Final question. I was lunching with my colleagues, one of my colleagues, John Oliphant, and he swears he's at 6.5 minutes. How close are you to your 5 minute mile?
Nowhere. I've got to about 5:40 and tore my calf. I've now gone to half marathon distance to hide my shame.
So I'm
slowing down. I'll be back.
All right. Well, we'll try and catch you if we can. Thank you so much, Adrian Gore. Such a pleasure to chat to you. Thanks for your candor. Have a great evening. Adrian Gore, the CEO of Discovery Group, giving us his perspectives on health, the economy, the healthcare system in general, some positive highlights, especially if you're a Discovery shareholder. And John, you better stay above 6 minutes.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.